Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
Republican congressman uses audio from baseball shooting in ad. By Maya Roden. Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks, who is running for Senate, released a campaign ad that features audio from the shooting at a baseball diamond in Virginia that left four wounded, including House Majority Whip Steve Scalise. The 30-second ad, titled Second Amendment, labels the shooter, James Thomas Hodgkinson, as a Bernie Sanders supporter, and points fingers at the liberal media for shifting the conversation toward the issue of gun control after the incident occurred. In the ad, Brooks, who was at the scene and says he used his belt as a tourniquet on one of the wounded, is seen telling a reporter that he still has full faith in the Second Amendment in the shooting's aftermath. The Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, is to make sure we always have a republic, Brooks said in response to a reporter's question. So no, I'm not changing my position on any of the rights that we enjoy as Americans. Lawmakers went out of their way to avoid politicizing the shooting in its immediate aftermath. Both Speaker Paul Ryan and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi delivered statements on the shooting and avoided weighing in on the politics of it, which was striking given the extreme political views of the shooter. The ad has evoked a negative reaction from Scalise's chief of staff, who weighed in on the ad on Twitter, saying, "It makes my stomach turn." Scalise is still being hospitalized as a result of the shooting. He underwent surgery on July 13 to treat an infection.
President Trump says Obamacare has wreaked havoc on Americans. By Maya Roden. One day before the Senate votes whether to begin debate on repealing the Affordable Care Act, President Trump called the 2010 law death and a nightmare that has wreaked havoc on the lives of Americans. Speaking from the Blue Room in the White House Monday, Trump argued that Republicans who fail to support the motion to proceed on repealing the health care law will be supporting the existing law in essence. The question for every senator, Democrat or Republican, is whether they will side with Obamacare's architects, which have been so destructive to our country, or with its forgotten victims, he said. Any senator who votes against starting debate is telling America that you are fine with the Obamacare nightmare. Trump seemed to have an endless supply of insults for the Affordable Care Act and the promise of reforming the health care system, which he called a big, fat, ugly lie. He labeled Democrats obstructionists for not supporting legislation to overturn the Affordable Care Act, though Republicans have the majority in both chambers and need just 50 votes to pass the bill. The Senate is poised to vote on repeal and replace legislation this week, though it is not exactly clear which version of the bill will be up for a vote. The Senate effort is facing an uphill battle regardless, given some Republicans' feelings on the bill who are wary about some of the bill's proposals. President Trump, however, intensified the pressure he has been adding to the health care debate via Twitter during his fiery speech on Monday afternoon. "The American people have waited long enough. There has been enough talk and no action. Now is the time for action," he said. "Obamacare has broken our health care system. It's broken. It's gone." President Trump issued a warning to Republicans on Twitter on Sunday, saying the repercussions will be far greater than any of them understand if the GOP does not repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act.
What it's like to have exploding head syndrome, by Kate Samuelson. If you've ever heard a sudden loud noise in your sleep that turns out to be imaginary, you're not losing your mind. In fact, you're among the roughly 10 to 15% of people who have experienced exploding head syndrome, EHS, a phenomena that strikes as a person is falling asleep. Here's what you need to know about the condition. Exploding head syndrome can sound strange and disorienting. EHS starts when you hear a loud noise, ranging from the sound of fireworks and gunfire to thunder and lightning. It's generally painless and lasts just a few seconds. There's this sudden crescendo of noise, then a profound and jarring explosion of sound, electrical fizzing, and a bright flash in my vision, like someone has lit a spotlight in front of my face, an EHS sufferer explained to the BBC. People respond to EHS differently. Some think they've heard a real event and wake up confused, looking around for the source of the noise. Others, who have it more frequently, may find it anxiety-inducing and start avoiding sleep or feel panicky when they go to bed. Some people have even incorporated the episodes into conspiracy theories. Some individuals believe they're not natural events, but are essentially caused by malevolent government agencies, says Brian Sharpless, an associate professor at the American School of Professional Psychology at Argosy University, Northern Virginia, and author of the recent book Unusual and Rare Psychological Disorders. Sharpless has led studies on EHS. I've received a number of phone calls from conspiracy theorists who don't believe the scientific explanations. It may stem from problems with the brain shutting down. Because EHS occurs when a person is falling asleep, researchers think it may be connected to the brain having problems shutting down. The way I usually describe EHS is by considering the brain to be a computer, says Sharpless. You go through a series of steps when you're shutting down your computer, and your brain does the same thing. As you go to sleep, your auditory and visual neurons are normally inhibited. What we think happens during EHS is that instead of shutting down, these neurons fire all at once. When they do, they create a perception of sound, which is why sufferers hear the loud noises. Sharpless found that EHS is connected to isolated sleep paralysis, a condition in which a person wakes up unable to move or speak for a few minutes at a time. In a study of 211 undergraduate students, Sharpless and his team found that the overall EHS rate was 18%, and 37% of those with EHS also experienced sleep paralysis. EHS is not uncommon. EHS has a long history in medical literature, and the first reference dates back to 1870. I think it's actually not uncommon, Sharpless says. For most people, though, it happens rarely, and there's only a relatively very small number of people who experience it to the extent that it's problematic. The syndrome was initially thought to occur most commonly in women and those age 50 and over, but in his research, Sharpless has found that about 13% of undergraduates have experienced it at least once. However, more research is needed to determine which groups of people are more likely to be sufferers and how prevalent it is. There isn't much you can do about it. There are no well-established treatments for EHS, and there has never been a controlled trial for it, Sharpless says. It's probably not shocking to hear that there's not a lot of money to study EHS and that many doctors have never even heard of it, he says. The best piece of advice for sufferers is to not freak out and to realize that it's a natural event, Sharpless says. Those who experience EHS to a high degree where its frequency or intensity is particularly troubling may be advised to use antidepressants, calcium channel blockers, which are often used with headache disorders, or an anti-seizure medication. In general, anytime you have sleep disorders, one of the best and easiest things to do is regulate your sleep by going to bed and waking up at the same time, and to avoid using alcohol or caffeine prior to bed, Sharpless says. Simple things like that can really lead to a reduction in episodes. If it is EHS, it's not dangerous and is just one of those strange experiences you can tell your boyfriend or girlfriend about when you wake up.
Watch The Rockin' Siri co-star in a crazy new Apple ad. By Julia Zorthian. Dwayne The Rock Johnson put another project on his plate, advertising for Apple. His busy schedule is the subject of an Apple ad that just dropped, titled The Rock vs. Siri, Dominate the Day. It may only last 3 minutes and 45 seconds, but Johnson teased the ad as the biggest, coolest, sexiest, funnest, is that a word, movie ever, in a tweet on Sunday before its release. Watch the new ad to see Johnson circle the globe to knock out items on his to-do list, all with the help of Siri, Apple's voice assistant. Apple tapped Johnson, a major star who has allowed speculation about a presidential run, for the advertisement at a time when data shows Siri usage has declined. Another tweet from Johnson, in which he says he and Apple are just getting started, suggests that this isn't the last buddy film starring The Rock and Siri we can expect to see.
This is The Easiest Way to Solve Disagreements About Money by Chris Wilson. Chris Wilson is the director of data journalism at Time.com. Most couples are delighted when they come into a windfall of cash or decide it's time for a spending splurge, right up until they start arguing about what to buy. A 2014 Money poll found that finances are the biggest subject of romantic fights, which is perhaps unnecessary. 64 years earlier, the famed mathematician John Nash proposed an elegant solution to any argument over money. Nash, the subject of A Beautiful Mind, wrote an 8-page paper in 1950 titled The Bargaining Problem that offered a basic equation for how two people can divide anything that's quantifiable, money, space, pizza, to maximum joint benefit. Nash's formula is one of many noted by Wellesley College mathematics professor Oscar Fernandez in his recent book, The Calculus of Happiness, which surveys a wide variety of ways that mathematics can be used to improve decision-making and general well-being. The way it works is simple. Whenever two people are deciding how to divvy up a shared resource, they each just have to rate how happy they would be if they got all of it on a scale of 1 to 10, as well as how happy they would be if they can't reach an agreement and have to give up without either person getting anything. In consultation with Fernandez, we created an interactive tool to resolve any financial dispute using Nash's formula by answering how you should split the money and whether you should make a deal at all. Hopefully, this can help settle an argument with a spouse, lover, friend, or even foe. Here's how the math works. The output of Nash's formula is the amount of money, or pizza, each person gets, adding up to the total. To measure the quality of the bargain, it takes the percentage of the total that each person got and multiplies it by the degree of happiness they would have experienced if they got all of it. So, if a person rates their ideal satisfaction as an 8 on the 1 to 10 scale and gets 75% of the money, their happiness is considered to be 6. It then subtracts the baseline happiness they would feel if negotiations were to fall apart to measure how much more satisfied they are with the agreement than they would be if there was none. Last, it takes this figure for both parties and multiplies them together, a value called the Nash product. The magic of Nash's equation is that it can determine, with simple algebra, the split that would produce the highest value for this product. As you might have noticed, the Nash product is not designed to solve every possible scenario. If two people both really want something, but would still be fairly happy if they got nothing, then there's no solution that produces a net gain in happiness for both parties. For example, if both people would experience a level of happiness of 9 with all of the money, but a level of 6 if no deal is reached, then even if they split the money, they'd each have a happiness of 4.5, which is less than if they got nothing. This might seem puzzling, since one would think that an even divide is still better than no reward at all. The assumption is that if both parties are so invested in the negotiation, then they'd rather make no deal than get an unfair portion. No arrangement will satisfy either of them. In reality, most people would probably not be happy with a failed compromise, which makes the formula more likely to produce a valid deal. Nash did not specifically design his formula for couples, but it applies equally well to romantic partners as it does to adversaries who need to divvy up, say, the proceeds of a joint bank heist. Whatever the circumstances, it finds the ideal balance that attends to both a person's investment in getting their way and their willingness to walk away if they don't. The Nash product counters and balances all of these forces, Fernandez says. In circumstances where at first no deal can produce a positive gain in happiness for both parties, the formula suggests that both people need to reevaluate how much they want something and how invested they are in working out a deal. The best way to correct a no-deal situation is for at least one party to choose an outcome that increases his or her level of happiness or reduces his or her willingness to abandon the bargain. In that respect, the formula has the therapeutic power to push both parties to reconsider what would make them happiest and how invested they are in coming to an agreement. Says Fernandez, it's the math trying to encourage you to change your behavior. Nash is best remembered for his contributions to game theory, a branch of mathematics that studies the ideal behavior of rational people in competitive circumstances. The field has wide applications in areas like economics and diplomacy, where the stakes can be high and a little math can go a long way toward counseling the best decisions. It comes up less often in the field of relationship science known as marriage. Fernandez would like to change that because he believes that even a smidgen of algebra can encapsulate a lot of wisdom. It's almost like the math is trying to tell you something, he says.
President Trump brags about his election victory during Boy Scout Jamboree speech. by Alana Abramson. President Donald Trump spoke Monday night at the 2017 Boy Scout Jamboree, where he bragged about his victory over Hillary Clinton in the 2016 campaign and bashed the media. "Who the hell wants to talk about politics when I'm in front of the Boy Scouts?" Trump asked the crowd sarcastically at the beginning of his speech, but that's exactly what he did, reliving election night 2016, or as he called it, that famous night on television. "You remember that incredible night with the maps," Trump said, noting that the maps were so red that the pundits who had expected a Clinton victory were speechless. He continued to recount his Electoral College victories, explaining he decided to visit Maine, a state that splits its electoral votes, in an effort to pick one up because he thought it would help him win. "But then Wisconsin came in," he said of election night. "Many, many years. Michigan came in, and we worked hard there. You know, my opponent didn't work hard there. She, Clinton, was told she was going to win Michigan, and I said, 'Wait a minute, the car industry is going to move to Mexico.'" "We'd go to Wisconsin, and we had these massive crowds," Trump continued. "What we did, in all fairness, is an unbelievable tribute to you and all the millions and millions that came out to make America great again." While he offered platitudes and words of encouragement to the scouts in attendance, the speech felt more like a campaign rally than an address to a children's organization. "Under the Trump administration, you'll be saying Merry Christmas again when you go shopping," Trump said. He lamented how his predecessor Barack Obama never visited a Boy Scout jamboree during his tenure, which elicited a series of boos from the crowd. Obama didn't visit the event, but did record a video for it in 2010, according to The Hill. He derided the media for what he said would be inevitable failures to report his crowd sizes, even as networks and reporters on Twitter were showing it. He also incorporated an anecdote about real estate developer William Levitt and their encounter at a cocktail party where he told Trump he had lost his momentum. Trump appeared to be using that as an inspiration for the Boy Scouts to not lose their own momentum. Trump said he wanted to stay away from the policy fights brewing in Washington, D.C. Although he made a reference about the need for more loyalty, he did not mention anything about the Russia investigation, including his son-in-law Jared Kushner's closed-door meeting with the Senate Intelligence Committee, or whether he will sign pending legislation on Russian sanctions. He did, however, reiterate the need for the Senate to repeal Obamacare. The chamber is slated to vote on a motion to proceed to debate on Tuesday. Calling his Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Price, to the stage, and seemingly joking that he would fire him if he was unable to round up the necessary votes to pass it.
We're begging for education. Meet the teacher who panhandled to buy her class school supplies. Authored for Time by Katie Riley. An Oklahoma teacher stood at a highway intersection panhandling for school supplies last week. She was surprised when she made $52 in 10 minutes and overwhelmed by the support she received online in the days that followed. But the interaction that affected her most was a young woman who approached her donating her waitressing tips and said, quote, "I'm alive today because of a teacher like you." Teresa Danks, a third-grade teacher at Grimes Elementary School in Tulsa, Oklahoma, said, "That just choked me up." She set out to raise money for her classroom and send a message about education funding challenges that she thinks too few people understand. Oklahoma has recently led the nation in cuts to general education funding per student, according to a report by the nonpartisan Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Oklahoma also ranked 49th out of 50 states and the District of Columbia for average teacher salary, which was $45,276 in the state in 2016, according to a report by the National Education Association. Danks, who is 50, said she typically spends $2,000 to $3,000 of her $35,000 salary on classroom supplies every year. Recent budget cuts have worsened the financial burden on teachers who are often tasked with purchasing their own classroom supplies. Oklahoma's budget crisis has led to larger class sizes, textbook shortages, and, in some districts, a four-day school week, according to the Washington Post, who published an article about this issue in May. Danks told Time magazine, quote, "It's just getting to the point where we don't have anything else to cut." She stood outside last Wednesday with a sign that read, "Teacher needs school supplies, anything helps." She was hoping to draw attention to her need for supplies for art and science projects. Beads, pipe cleaners, pom-poms, googly eyes, and paper towels, and then continue raising money online. She said, quote, "I mean, they sound silly, but these kinds of things are what you need. Paper towel rolls, toilet paper rolls, they make good little rocket ships when we do our solar system study." And then she continued, "Most of the kids will never leave the city they live in or the rural community they live in, so teachers are trying to bring the world to them." Deborah Gist, superintendent of Tulsa Public Schools, said state budget cuts have really been difficult for the school system. Quote, "We certainly know, and I know personally from having been a teacher for many years, that it is unfortunately commonplace in our country for teachers to invest many hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars into their classroom." She added that she took a second job at a pet store and later as a restaurant hostess to make money for her classroom when she was a teacher in Texas. Just continued, quote, "We try to do what we can to make up for the lack of investment on the part of our state and our schools, and I'll continue to advocate for that," end quote. After Danks' brief panhandling stint, she posted photos of her effort on Facebook and created a GoFundMe page, which had raised $35,000 as of Monday afternoon, surpassing her $2,000 goal for her own classroom. Danks plans to continue raising money to give to other teachers in partnership with DonorsChoose.org, an organization that has raised more than $500 million to fund classroom projects for public school teachers across the country. She said, quote, "I am definitely going to be pushing forward this movement. I would love to see teachers across America standing out there with their signs saying that we're just begging for education." This article was authored for Time by Katie Riley. More evidence that owning a dog is really good for you. Authored for Time Health by Julia Zorthian. Dogs are more than just cuddly companions. Research continues to show that pets bring real health benefits to their owners. Having a dog around can lead to lower levels of stress for both adults and kids. They've been found to decrease the risk of asthma in children and have been linked to lower blood pressure. And researchers have also shown that dog owners are more active than those who don't own dogs, packing in more steps per day on their walks or just regular playtime. Last month, a study showed that older dog owners take 2,760 more steps per day on average compared to non-owners, which amounted to an additional 23 daily minutes of moderate exercise. Now, a new study in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health shows how enduring that phenomenon is. Dog owners are also significantly more active during the winter. Researchers from the University of East Anglia and the Center for Diet and Activity Research at the University of Cambridge used data from the European Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition Norfolk cohort, and they focused their study on 3,123 participants between the ages of 49 and 91. Nearly 20% of those participants owned a dog, and they all wore an accelerometer for 7 days to track their movements. The researchers found that the people who didn't own a dog were sedentary for about 30 minutes more a day on average than those who walked their dogs. Everyone who participated in the study was less active on shorter days, colder days, and days with more precipitation. But the researchers discovered that even during days with bad weather, dog walkers were more active than non-dog walkers were on the nicest days. Project lead Andy Jones, a UEA professor, said in a press release, quote, "We were amazed to find that dog walkers were on average more physically active and spent less time sitting on the coldest, wettest, and darkest days than non-dog owners were on long, sunny, and warm summer days," end quote. Dog walkers got in an average of 12 more minutes of activity on the wettest days, for example, than those who don't own dogs got on the driest days. Overall, on the driest days, dog walkers were sedentary for an average of 632 minutes compared to non-dog owners, 661 minutes. Jones said this finding could have important implications about how to motivate people to stay active as they age. Physical activity interventions typically try and support people to be active by focusing on the benefits to themselves, but dog walking is also driven by the needs of the animal. Jones continued in the release, quote, "Being driven by something other than our own needs might be a healthy, potent motivator, and we need to find ways of tapping into it when designing exercise interventions in the future." I'm Steve Ray. This article was authored for Time Health by Julia Zorthian. 10 Billionaires with Surprisingly Frugal Money Habits, authored by Sergei Klebnikov for Money Magazine. As Belarusian American chess master Charles A. Jaffe once claimed, quote, "It's not your salary that makes you rich, it's your spending habits." Not surprisingly, many of the wealthiest people on earth have distinct penny-pinching habits that have paved the road to their success and vast fortunes. Incorporate some of these habits into your own life, and perhaps your own net worth will grow. Number 1. Mark Zuckerberg drives a $30,000 car. Despite being able to buy a Ferrari for every day of the month, the Facebook founder drives a non-ostentatious Volkswagen GTI with manual transmission, which costs only $30,000. Other cost-saving tricks. He reportedly married longtime girlfriend Priscilla Chan in their backyard, and the two were seen eating at a McDonald's during their 2012 Italian honeymoon trip. While Zuckerberg bought his most recent home in 2011, a $7 million house in Palo Alto, some called it still well below his means. Number 2. Warren Buffett still resides in the same home he bought for $31,500 in 1958. Known as the Oracle of Omaha, longtime chairman and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett is one of the richest people on the planet, but he still lives in his 6,000-square-foot, 5-bedroom stucco house in Omaha, Nebraska. He's described the purchase as, quote, "the third best investment I've ever made." A familiar 5-bedroom house located next door went on sale in 2015 for a list price of 10 A shares of Berkshire Hathaway stock, equal to over $2.5 million today. Number 3. Bill Gates wears a $10 watch. Forget Rolex. Adorning Bill Gates's wrist is a $10 watch, and perhaps most frugally, Gates remains old-fashioned in that he still likes to wash the dishes at home every night for his family, because dishwashers use electricity after all. Number 4. Charlie Ergen, the founder and chairman of Dish Network, still packs a brown bag lunch from home every day. Of course, eating out is super expensive. Dish Network founder battles those costs with a simple and inexpensive paper bag lunch before work every day, consisting of a sandwich and Gatorade from home. He and his wife have lived in the same Denver house for over 20 years. Until recently, the Dish CEO also stuck to company policy by sharing hotel rooms with colleagues while traveling for business. As Ergen once told the Financial Times, "My mom grew up in the Depression. I don't have a mahogany desk." Number 5. Carlos Slim Helu, Mexico's richest man, drives himself around town and to work every day. Many who dream of being rich dream of a chauffeur, not Mexican telecom magnate Carlos Slim Helu, who drives himself around town in an old Mercedes-Benz, buys clothes off the rack at his own retail stores, and for over 40 years has lived in the same modest 6-bedroom house in Mexico where he raised his kids. Number 6. Jim Walton works out of a plain old brick building in his hometown. Walmart scion and member of America's richest family, Jim Walton inherited the down-to-earth spending habits of his father, Walmart founder Sam Walton. These days, he runs the family's Arvest Bank, which boasts assets of more than $16 billion, from the upstairs floor of a plain old brick building. Despite his massive fortune, Jim Walton prefers pickup trucks to fancy sports cars. He reportedly drives around a rusting Dodge Dakota pickup that is over 15 years old. Number 7. John Caldwell, English businessman and co-founder of mobile phone retailer Phones For You, cuts his own hair. This now retired self-made billionaire who built a British cell phone empire still maintains many aspects of a budget lifestyle. He reportedly still cuts his own hair, refrains from buying expensive wines, and buys his clothes off the rack at British retailer Marks & Spencer. He once told Forbes, quote, "I don't need Seville Rose suits." Number 8. Amancio Ortega, the founder of Spanish multinational clothing conglomerate Inditex, eats lunch with employees in the Zara cafeteria. The tycoon behind Zara still lives humble. Not only does Ortega live in a discreet apartment building with his wife, but he also frequents the same local coffee shop in his home city of La Coruña, Spain, on a regular basis. Known as the pioneer of fast fashion, Ortega dresses very modestly given his status, with a uniform of a blue blazer, white shirt, and gray pants every day. Perhaps most surprising, however, is that he still eats lunch alongside his employees in the company cafeteria. Number 9, David Cheriton, the professor billionaire who teaches at Stanford University, reuses tea bags. Food can be a huge source of wasted money, as computer scientist and Stanford professor David Cheriton attests. He makes sure to save half of his meal for the next day when eating at an expensive restaurant. Instead of luxury cars, Cheriton prefers to ride his bike. When he does need to drive, he relies on his 1986 Volkswagen van or an old Honda sedan. He has also said that he only flies commercial, prefers jeans instead of expensive designer clothes, and even reuses his tea bags. And number 10, Azim Premji, India's wealthiest tech tycoon, is said to monitor the number of toilet paper rolls used by employees. Despite his success serving over 5 decades as chairman of Indian tech services giant Wipro Limited, Premji lives a surprisingly low-budget lifestyle and is extremely careful with his spending. The bare-bones billionaire often takes a 3-wheel auto rickshaw from the Bangalore airport when returning home from business trips. When traveling, he only drives second-hand cars such as an old Toyota Corolla, flies in economy class, and stays at company guest houses instead of 5-star hotels. His well-known frugality also extends beyond his personal life. At Wipro facilities, he reportedly keeps close tabs on toilet paper usage and always reminds employees to turn off the lights when leaving their offices. As one worker anonymously told Bloomberg, Premji, quote, makes Uncle Scrooge look like Santa Claus, end quote. I'm Steve Ray. The preceding article was authored for Money Magazine by Sergei Klebnikov.
Child with HIV has been in remission for nearly 9 years without drugs. By Alexandra Sifferlin. HIV researchers announced on Monday that a 9-year-old child from South Africa has been living with HIV in remission for almost 9 years without continuing the use of HIV drugs. Researchers say this is the third case of prolonged HIV remission after early treatment. The study adds to new but growing evidence that early treatment of HIV in children beginning in infancy may bring HIV to undetectable levels and potentially lower the need for lifelong drug therapy. At the 9th Annual International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Science in Paris, researchers presented the results on the child who was diagnosed with HIV in 2007, 32 days after birth, and enrolled in a clinical trial. In the trial, infants diagnosed with the virus were randomly assigned to either receive delayed antiretroviral therapy, ART, or to be given early ART treatment for 40 or 96 weeks, at which point it would be stopped. The South African child is among 143 infants who received ART for 40 weeks. The child had very high levels of HIV in the blood before starting treatment when it was about 9 weeks old. With treatment, levels of the virus dropped to a point where they were no longer detectable. After 40 weeks of treatment, researchers stopped the therapy and tracked the child closely. So far, the child has maintained nearly undetectable levels of the virus. Scientists were able to detect a small supply of virus in a very small portion of immune cells, but so far they have not found evidence of an HIV infection, and the child has shown no symptoms of the disease. The child is the third to reach long-term remission with no drugs. In 2010, a child referred to as the Mississippi Baby was born with HIV and began treatment just 30 hours after birth. The treatment was stopped when the child reached around 18 months. After a couple of years, however, the virus reappeared and the child was put back on ART. In 2015, scientists reported another case in a French child. According to the case study, a French baby was born with HIV in 1996 and received treatment when it was 3 months old. The child stopped treatment a few years later and has continued to control the virus without drugs. To our knowledge, this is the first reported case of sustained control of HIV in a child enrolled in a randomized trial of ART interruption following treatment early in infancy, said study author A.V. Valari, head of pediatric research at the Perinatal HIV Research Unit, in a statement. The study authors believe that other factors may be contributing to why the South African's child immune system has been so successful at keeping HIV levels down, and they plan to keep following the child and study its immune system. Currently, doctors and scientists start children with HIV on ART and do not stop the treatment. According to Valari, the child in the new case study partook in the trial 10 years ago when treatment guidelines for children were different. Although the medications have risks, the benefits far outweigh the risks, said Valari in an email to Time. At this stage, we don't recommend any child stops treatment.
Stubbs, the honorary cat mayor of a small Alaskan town, has died. By Tara John. Stubbs, the honorary feline mayor of Talkeetna, Alaska, has died at the age of 20. The cat's owner announced his death on Saturday, noting that Stubbs lived for 20 years and 3 months. He was a trooper until the very last day of his life, meowing at us through the day to pet him or come sit on the bed with him and let him snuggle and purr for hours in our lap, the Spohn family wrote in a statement. Stubbs was elected honorary mayor as a kitten in 1997, when local residents, unhappy with their human candidates, decided to write him in on the ballot, CNN reports. Despite lacking legislative powers, Stubbs has only grown in popularity since. Over 75% of visitors ask, "Where's the mayor?" or come in with this statement, "I have an appointment with the mayor," the Spohn family wrote. The family purchased Nagley's General Store and the West Rib Pub and Grill in 2015, with the former doubling as Stubbs' office, according to CNN. Going forward, the Spohn family hinted that Denali, one of their other kittens, may assume Stubbs' role. "We couldn't have asked for a better understudy than Denali. He really has followed in Stubbs' paw prints in just about everything."
Go inside a 1967 tour bus as it visits San Francisco during the Summer of Love by Lily Rothman. It was billed as the only foreign tour in the domestic United States, but the hippies were the ones taking the trip. At least, that was the gimmick used by a tour company that organized a bus trip around San Francisco for tourists to gawk at the hippies who had flocked to that city in 1967. The Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco is not so much a neighborhood as a state of mindlessness, Time had explained earlier that year, as the city sat on the cusp of what would come to be known as the Summer of Love. The Erewhon of America's Pot Left, a 10-by-15 block midtown section, has over the past year become the center of a new utopianism, compounded of drugs and dreams, free love and LSD. It is a far cry from the original utopia, envisioned some 400 years ago by Sir Thomas More, whose denizens demanded 6 hours of work each day. The 7,000 mind-blown residents of San Francisco's Psychedelphia demand a zero-hour day and free freakouts for all. As seen in the clip from the PBS American Experience documentary Summer of Love, which is being rebroadcast on Tuesday in honor of the 50th anniversary of that remarkable season, what was going on in San Francisco intrigued those who would not themselves have been interested in tuning in, turning on, or dropping out. As filmmaker Gail Dalgin said in a statement about the project, the California city seemed like Mecca for the young people looking for a visionary new society. It seemed more like the moon for straight society, with visitors hoping to catch a glimpse at the outside from the protective distance of a moving vehicle. After all, as Time would note in a cover story on the movement, perhaps the most striking thing about the hippie phenomenon is the way it has touched the imagination of the straight society that gave it birth. How to Get Your Kids to Read by Jane Borden from Real Simple. At some point, most kids will have to go solo. Encourage a reluctant reader to knock out those required pages with these tips. Schedule it. "My kids don't always want to go to the grocery store with me, but they know it happens every week," says Carrie Riddell, founder of the website Brookopolis. "We set aside time for soccer practice. Why not to read?" Don't compete with electronics. You'll never win. Incorporate them instead. Try apps such as Epic, Reading Rainbow Skybrary Family, and Newsomatic. Download books onto your phone so the kids find them there too. Advocate for options. An article in School Library Journal noted that teachers estimated a 30% jump in reading when children chose books themselves. Talk to teachers, advocate for summer reading lists that are broad, allow choice, and include modern books, says Jen Robinson, a blogger at growingbookworms.com. For younger kids who have to complete reading logs, ask teachers to allow alternative journaling, such as illustrating a new cover, writing a letter to the author, or creating a map of a book setting, says Kira Parrott, reviews director at School Library Journal. Be a negotiator. Riddell used this tactic on her middle schooler. I tell him, you want me to drive you to baseball 3 times a week? I want you to read for 20 minutes a day. It's quid pro quo and a little bit of guilt, but it sometimes works. Know when to quit. Sometimes it's okay to skip hard parts, and sometimes it's okay to abandon a book, says Pam Allen, founder of Lit World and author of What to Read When. If it's a mandatory book, say to your kid, you read a page and then I'll read a page. Be an ally. He won't remember that hard book. What he will remember is you advocating for him to be a reader. It's totally fine to get the audiobook. When all else fails, Riddell suggests letting your kid listen to the first chapters to hook her and then transitioning to the text, or swap chapter by chapter. Says Allen, I'm a big advocate for reading aloud, whether it's you or the audio version. This article originally appeared on realsimple.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.